getting ready for the solar eclipse and suggestions for summer stargazing. Next month, Maine, along with the rest of North America, will experience a solar eclipse. But the moon passing between the Earth and the sun isn't the only event making news outside of Earth's orbit. President Trump saying, quote, "The next great American frontier is space," signed an executive order reestablishing the National Space Council. The council was originally formed 60 years ago with the goal of coordinating the nation's activities beyond Earth. SpaceX continues to have success launching rockets into space and then reusing the booster rockets. Another private space launch company, Blue Origin, backed by Amazon chief executive Jeff Bezos, announced plans to build rockets in Alabama. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today we'll head out of Earth's atmosphere and want to hear from you. What questions do you have about space exploration? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. And from the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Erwin Gratz. This is Maine Calling. Well, earlier this month, President Trump reestablished the National Space Council. The goal, according to the president, is to have the U.S. lead in space once again. Well, today we're going to talk about outer space and even some things visible up there from the ground here. Joining me in our Portland studio is Edward Gleason. He's the University of Southern Maine's planetarium manager. Bernie Rehm is also in our studio. He's the author of the monthly astronomy column in the Portland Press Herald and an astronomy lab instructor at the University of Southern Maine. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Sean Latch. He's the director of the Amara Astronomy Center and Jordan Planetarium at UMaine. As always, we're happy to hear from you. Are you an amateur stargazer? Well, you can share your favorite sightings or ask our experts a question about the Milky Way, the search for exoplanets, or whatever. Our phone number here, 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And gentlemen, welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
All right, well, let's start with the big cosmic wink that we'll all be in, that will be enjoyed by many millions of Americans and some foreign visitors too. On August 21st, a total solar eclipse is going to occur, and its path will sweep right across the lower 48 from Oregon, south of Portland, the other Portland, to about Charleston, South Carolina. It will be the first total solar eclipse to touch the U.S. mainland in 38 years, the first widely visible in the U.S. since 1970. Bernie Rehm, I'm going to begin with you and a very elementary question. Now, about every 4 weeks, the moon actually swings between the Earth and the sun, what we call a new moon, every 28 days. But solar eclipses are very rare.
Yes, they're much more rare than that for several reasons, actually. The Earth, sun, and moon have to line up exactly for any kind of eclipse to occur, and that only happens twice a year, either on the ascending or the descending node. And then a lot of other events have to happen. So if you have any given place on the Earth, you would actually only see a total of solar eclipse once in 400 years. So we're pretty lucky now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ed Gleason, if you happen to be stuck here on August 21st, will there be anything to see?
There will be something to see. It will be a partial solar eclipse. The obscuration will be about 58.8% in Portland, less as you go farther north in the state. We were talking earlier today about the difference between magnitude and obscuration. Because we say the magnitude is about 0.67, that means that about 0.67% of the sun's diameter will be blocked by the moon. But what that actually means mathematically is it'll cover just under 59% of the sun's face. Now, unfortunately, we won't have the same effects that people will see in the totality path, the corona, the Bailey speeds, the diamond ring effect. All those beautiful effects won't actually be visible here, but you will see a partial obscuration of the sun by the moon, which will require protective glasses for you to be able to see it safely.
All right, Sean Latch, let's get you in here. Let's talk a little bit more about those tips for people who do plan to view, especially the partial phases of the eclipse here or anywhere, really. How do people safely watch a solar eclipse?
Yeah, it's essential to use adequate eye protection, of course, when you're viewing a solar eclipse. The only time it's safe to look at eclipse without that is during totality, which, of course, will not take place here in Maine this go-round. Good news is in 2024, there will be a total solar eclipse passing through Maine. So if you can wait 7 years, there's a chance to see totality here. But during the partial phases, you do want to wear solar protection. And sunglasses won't do that, of course, because they don't protect you from the rays of the sun. They just protect you from glare. So typically you want solar glasses, solar filter glasses, which are widely available. A whole variety of libraries in the United States actually have been getting glasses from NASA to distribute freely for this event, helping people to see it safely. If you don't have access to that, there is a way of doing pinhole projection. Basically, you can use an index card or a piece of cardboard, stand with your back towards the sun, poke a hole through it, and let the sun shine through that index card, and it will project an image of the partial phases, on the ground. And that's a great way to view it safely. Again, your back is turned towards the sun, so you don't have a chance of, you know, getting the sunlight, because the sun is really powerful. And those solar eclipse filter glasses block out 99.9% of the light. So again, and that's very important, because it will burn the retina of your eye, and, that can do some serious damage. So you do need to wear protection.
All right. And once the moon is completely or completely blocks the sun, if you are watching totality, what will you see?
Well, I actually want to defer this to Sean, because I've never actually seen a total solar eclipse.
Yes, right. I haven't either.
Okay.
So, I mean, again, Sean, I can tell you what people have seen, but I figured I should defer this to you, Sean.
All right.
Sure. I can say it is one of the most spectacular events in all of nature. I've had a chance to see two total solar eclipses during my lifetime, and for this one coming up, I'm actually going to be in Idaho in the Path of Totality trying to take a look at it, even though there will be some events up at Orono at the observatory there. But it is spectacular. I mean, you don't get complete darkness in the middle of the day, but you do get an eerie twilight effect all the way around the horizon. It does sort of look almost like there's a hole in the sky. It's really an amazing experience. And of course, you see the corona, which is beautiful and looks different during each total solar eclipse, because whether the sun is at a maximum or a minimum will determine that shape of the corona. Sometimes it's more sort of uniform around, other times it's more of like a bipolar flow, which is really amazing. But it is one of the most spectacular things. You'll feel the temperature drop. The color of the sky is really incredible. And it does get dark enough to see some of the brighter planets like Venus and Jupiter, depending on their proximity to the sun as well, and some of the brighter stars. But it's not a total darkness in the sense of it's not as black as night. You're not going to see the Milky Way during a total solar eclipse, for instance. But it is really spectacular and very moving for folks who see it. Once you see one, you'll want to see another one.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Ed was saying before, I think, that it is safe, or maybe you were saying before, it's safe, of course, to look directly at the sun once totality has begun. What about magnification during that time, whether it be through binoculars or telescope? Is that safe once you reach totality?
It is. You just have to be very careful that you're paying attention to when totality starts and finishes, because you don't want to be looking through binoculars or something else or a telescope at the sun during totality and have it come out without that filter, because then there's a serious problem. And, you know, a lot of folks will want to photograph these total solar eclipses as well. And I often tell them just to take it in the first time you see one, just take it in with your eyes, because if you're fiddling with your camera, you'll miss the main event. And this year in particular, there's only 2 minutes and 40 seconds if you're at the maximum point, which will be over Kentucky, in terms of the maximum duration. So these things are short-lived, and you can look at it safely during totality with magnification, because the corona is really just a very faint, it's that outer atmosphere of the sun, and it's very faint, and it's not, but it really has some spectacular detail in it.
That's also the area of the solar atmosphere, is it not, that gets very hot compared to the sun's surface?
Yes, yeah, it's much warmer than the surface of the sun. Typically, it can be as much as 2 million degrees, whereas the surface of the sun, about 10,000 degrees or so. So, it is much warmer. Of course, it's much thinner and very tenuous, but yes, it is an extremely hot region of the sun.
Ed Gleason.
And from viewing it during a solar eclipse, we actually discovered helium. That was the first time that was discovered, was looking during a solar eclipse in the 1800s. So it's been useful to science and also in terms of proving relativity. It's a very useful thing for scientists as well as a beautiful, spectacular thing to see.
Well, it leads right into my next question, because there has been a lot of great science done around solar eclipses before. Is there still science to do, Ed Gleason?
There's a lot of observation to do. You probably mentioned the Eddington Expedition 1919, in which they determined the slight distortion of the star's path because it's passing through the sun's field. What they're going to do now, a lot of astronomers will be looking at it. A lot of what can be done has already been done. So mostly it's aesthetics. Mostly it's just watching this beautiful display of nature. And NASA's always asking people to observe it, to pass in their observations of the corona and of the timing, just for verification purposes. That will probably be largely the extent of the science that will be performed during this eclipse.
Bernie?
Yes, well, I did hear they're going to put some balloons up about 100,000 feet. So they're going to see a couple different effects that they haven't seen, and they're going to try to stitch everything together, and maybe get some new science that way, study specific parts of it and so on.
All right. Well, one other thing that I know Charles Beck specifically wanted me to mention, but this is interesting. If you are not, or even if you are, privileged to be in the Path of Totality on August 21st, PBS's NOVA program apparently is going to do something live that evening, reporting on Eclipse Day. That'll be on Monday, August 21st, 9 p.m., a program that will repeat at NOVA's usual time, which is the following Wednesday at 8 o'clock. Well, we have lots more stuff to talk about today about outer space. Let's start with something else that's going on today. This evening, there is an American space probe by the name of Juno that is going to make a close flyby of Jupiter tonight right over the Great Red Spot. Ed Gleason, tell us about the Great Red Spot. What is it?
Well, the Great Red Spot is a storm in Jupiter's atmosphere. It is larger than Earth, and it's still a question as to how long it has endured. There were observations by Robert Hooke and Giovanni Cassini in the mid-17th century. We're not sure if they were actually seeing the Great Red Spot or not. I mean, Cassini was observing it until the early 18th century. But then there was about a century of non-observation, so we're not sure if they were seeing the same thing. We do know that it has been observed consistently since the early 19th century, and it persists today. Now, on Earth, we know that storms don't last that long. Frictional wearing with the ground causes, like, for instance, hurricanes to dissipate relatively quickly. This storm has been more than a century and a half old. We don't know how long it will persist. It could persist for a century or more. And one question that scientists want to answer is, what mechanism is enabling it to last for so long? And, again, they're still trying to study the chemical conditions in the Jupiter atmosphere, and then knowing exactly the mechanisms that cause these storms and give them such endurance.
Mm. And, of course, the other thing that's interesting about the Great Red Spot, though, it is shrinking, is it not?
It is shrinking. It doesn't maintain a consistent area, and it is shrinking somewhat. They also want to know what mechanism is causing it to shrink again, because there's no solid surface for it to rub against to cause it to dissipate. So they'd like to know a lot more about the mechanisms that cause them to grow and to cause them to shrink.
Mm. Interesting. Sean, anything to add on that point?
Well, yeah, I think it's going to give us some really incredible images. Of course, the Juno spacecraft has really sort of changed the way we look at Jupiter, and some of the views of the clouds it's given us are really spectacular. It's also, you know, one of the things that the craft is doing is looking at the magnetic structure of Jupiter. We're really trying to get a deeper understanding of that. We've studied Jupiter over time, and of course, actually looking at the way that its atmosphere works, we were able to develop some of the early weather models for our planet. Of course, we did have to factor in, you know, the fact that we have land-water barriers and things that Jupiter doesn't have because it's a gas giant, but those initial observations sort of helped us understand sort of high-level wind flows here on planet Earth.
Bernie. Hmm.
Yes, well, the Juno mission is also especially interesting because people, regular citizen science, can actually help determine some of the images Juno will take. And the last time it took some images to the South Pole was quite dramatic. They had very colorful swirls, way more than expected, and it looked more like Van Gogh's Starry Night than you might expect Jupiter to look like.
Yeah, and different from Jupiter's North Pole, and that's one of the other things that at the moment people still don't understand completely.
Yeah, right. Oh, a lot of new things to learn all the time.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. And let's talk about another of those outer gas giant planets, Saturn. I think the last time we were on this program, we talked about the grand finale orbits of the Cassini space probe. It's now made several close flybys of the planet. It's actually slicing between the inner ring and Saturn itself. Have we learned any new things from those passes yet?
I think we've learned, for one thing, we've learned a little bit of the dynamics that sustain the rings. I mean, we knew that already that Enceladus's plumes have been feeding the E-ring. And I think now the pass...
Enceladus, by the way, one of its moons.
One of its moons, yes, yeah. I apologize. And the Cassini probe, again, is giving us lots of images, and it's giving them more of the dynamics of the ring particles themselves, because we know it consists of a lot of these particles, countless. And having them so close, you can see exactly how they interact. And that's one thing that is helping people to discover not only images of the moons, but the interactions of the ring particles. And, of course, the way it interacts with Saturn itself. And it's given us such images and such information pertaining to Saturn that no other probe has given us, and certainly no ground-based telescope has given us.
Mm-hmm. Sean, anything to add to that?
Yeah, it's one of the, I mean, just in terms of, as mentioned, it, having those probes there really gives us an incredible amount of information. And I think, you know, the Cassini mission will finish up this year, but it's a great example of how these robotic spacecraft actually give us the bulk of the really good science we get from traveling in space.
All right. Very good. Let us take our first break here. And when we come back, we've got some of your comments and questions straight ahead. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Goodwill Northern New England, with a 10-year goal of helping 10,000 households build stable lives through work. GoodwillNNE.org.
What if an ordinary bag of potato chips could listen to every word you said? Does it work with Doritos?
I suspect so.
Lay's, I'm assuming, will work fine.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm Guy Raz. What potato chips tell us about the hidden secrets all around us? Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And that's coming up Wednesday evening at 11 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Classical music goes well with the summer season here in Maine, and our growing Maine Public Classical Network is there to please, with virtually 24/7 great classical music. Maine Public Classical is currently heard on 5 FM frequencies, in Portland at 104.1, in Bangor at 106.1, Waterville at 99.7, Freiburg-Bridgeton at 91.5, and in the Millbridge MDI area at 93.7 FM. If you can't hear it over the air, remember, it's on the HD channel of this Maine Public Radio station you're now listening to, and also available online at mainepublic.org in a stereo stream. Maine Public Classical, how to find and listen to it. You'll find information online at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, the latest news from outside our Earth's atmosphere. With me in the studio, Edward Gleason, University of Southern Maine Planetarium Manager. Bernie Rehm, the author of the monthly astronomy column that appears in the Portland Press Herald, and an astronomy lab instructor at the University of Southern Maine. Joining us from our Bangor studio today, the director of the Amera Astronomy Center and Jordan Planetarium at the University of Maine, Sean Latch. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Hey, let's go to the phones right now and talk with Michael in Lincolnville. Michael, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Hey, everybody. Hey, thanks for letting me on.
You're welcome.
And that's great news about 2024. I have an eclipse simulation running on my website. It's heywhatsthat.com/eclipse. You can save some time. You can just type e.heywt.com.
And we'll put the information up on our Facebook page, too, for folks.
I was going to say, there are a lot of simulations on the web, but I think mine's unique for two reasons. One is on the page you'll see a map showing the shadow of the moon as it moves across the country, and next to it an image of the moon crossing the face of the sun, and there's a little play button in the bottom left-hand corner so you can animate the whole thing. And the second reason is, I think, I'm pretty sure this is the only simulation coming out of Lincolnville, and maybe all of Walden County.
Okay. Well, something tells me if it's not, we may hear from someone else. You never know.
Yeah, right. And I welcome any comments people have. Thanks a lot.
All right. Michael, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We've heard from Janet McKinney, who just wanted to mention what I think we touched on briefly. Many Maine public libraries do have special eclipse glasses to observe the eclipse and are offering special eclipse programs as well. So you might want to check out your local library for those. All right. Now, let's talk about something else. I wonder how many folks out there remember New Horizons. That's the probe that flew by Pluto just last year. After 2.5 years awake and gathering data, it's now taking a much-deserved 157-day nap that it began back on April 7th as it heads for another smaller target that's even farther out in the solar system. Edward, can you bring us up to date on that?
It's going up to try to find some Kuiper Belt objects. I mean, the New Horizons gave us unprecedentedly clear images of Pluto, and now it's going to meander through the Kuiper Belt to give us some images of those as well. And again, the Kuiper Belt is a region where short-period comets originate, and we know very little about it. We know a few bodies that are there, and the New Horizons probe will give us more close-up views of some of the other bodies. Again, there's no way to see them all. Right. It's just giving us a small sampling, but that's better than what we have now.
Yeah, the one that it's aiming for now has got the exotic name, 2014 MU69. Interestingly, I read just recently that apparently there's some question as to whether this is a single body or actually a collection of smaller bodies.
Like sometimes with some of Jupiter's moons, for instance, they're almost like amalgams that are just held together very tenuously. And so you never know exactly if this is a one-body object or if it's something that is just a small collection. And because the gravity out in that area is so tenuous, they're sort of like cleaving together with their own meager gravity. And also, there's nothing pushing them out as well. I mean, again, you could push them apart sometimes, but if there's nothing, there's no force externally driving them apart, they'll just essentially loiter together.
Yeah. Well, I guess the beauty of it is New Horizons should pass close enough to see one way or the other.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. January 1st, 2019, I think it's scheduled to be there.
Yep. All right. As we mentioned at the very top of the show, President Trump has reactivated the National Space Council. Do we have any picture yet of what direction this administration wants to pursue in space exploration? Has anybody seen or heard anything? Sean, anything?
Well, what I've heard is that, you know, there's a push for the human side of space flight and space exploration. That seems to be the big focus. You know, there's been talk of going to Mars before the end of his second term, or at least that he'd like to see folks do that. How realistic that is, I think, is up for a great discussion, you might say, given some of that. But yeah, it seems to be more of a focus on, you know, on human side of exploration. And while on the one hand that sounds great, you know, in terms of making a sort of a declaration, if you will, the human side of space exploration costs quite a bit more than the robotic side. And the robotic side gives us about 10 times as much science, or sometimes even 100 times as much science, you know, permission. So I think we have to think about that, because NASA's budget hasn't increased over the last several decades. It's actually decreased quite a bit. And if you really want to do human space exploration, you're going to need to spend a lot more on it. So that's something serious to consider.
Yeah. Edward.
Well, I haven't spent any time in Donald Trump's mind. I'm assuming that it's going to be an issue of national pride. And it's been considered by some to be ignominious that we really don't have a capability of going up into space anymore, except for private enterprise. I mean, we've been reliant on the Russians to get us to the International Space Station. My guess is he wants to revamp the program that would enable humans to go back into space as readily as they did with the space shuttle program. But as Sean mentioned, putting humans into space is much more logistically challenging. And as we've noticed with the probes that have gone to Saturn and Jupiter, you can do a lot more with robots with a lot less hassle. And so, again, if I had to guess, the focus will be just putting American astronauts back into space using NASA rockets, NASA.
We are getting closer, are we not, to at least the commercial crew programs, Boeing and also SpaceX, both developing capsules to take astronauts to and from the space station. They're getting kind of close to being ready to fly, are they not, Bernie?
Yes, I believe so. And there's the Orion spacecraft, too, has done some early flights that's going to be going up. So we're getting there slowly.
All right. All right. Let's talk about some exotic space science. This is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, which is located in Louisiana. Now, this is kind of old news that we're going to talk about here. A collision that occurred in space some 3 billion years ago. Word of which just reached us apparently in January. Mm-hmm. Somebody want to explain this? Bernie, you want to kick it off?
Yes. Well, this is the third confirmed gravitational wave that we've actually found. We had found a couple ones earlier that were about 1 billion light years away. This was 3 billion, as Irvin said. One of them was actually, the first one we found was about 62 solar masses. It was two black holes colliding. The next one was around 21 solar masses, and this one was about 49. So this LIGO, that gravitational wave observatory set up just to discover certain black holes of certain masses. Mm-hmm. So they have found that.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Ever?
And it verifies Einstein's general theory of relativity that predicted gravitational waves almost a century before they were discovered. And these waves are literally ripples in space-time. And what's really remarkable about gravitational waves as opposed to radiation is it doesn't undergo any absorption. I mean, radiation, when it propagates through space, goes through material that reddens it, that absorbs it. Gravitational waves are almost pure because what's literally happening, which is very exciting, is these waves are moving actually through space-time. And you need something catastrophic like black hole collisions, like neutron star collisions, to produce waves that are powerful enough to detect. When we say powerful enough, they're not causing any ripples. The dishes aren't going to fall off your shelves, but they will cause some disturbances in the LIGO. There's one in Louisiana, one in Washington State, and that also helps them somewhat pinpoint where they are because the first detector will go off, and then a fraction of a second later, the other one will go off as a gravitational wave goes right through Earth. And not only is it verifying general relativity, it's also opening up another way for astronomers to study the universe in the same way that happened once visible waves were also augmented by by ultraviolet rays, by gamma rays. So it's exciting to think of how much more astronomers can study just by detecting the gravitational waves that these distant, very remote catastrophic events will actually produce.
Want to remind you again, if you'd like to give us a call, got a question for our panel, we're available at 1-800-399-3566. You can also send an email to talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page, and we'd be very happy to hear from you when you're listening to Maine Calling right here on Maine Public Radio. You know, we were talking about LIGO and that collision of two black holes. Something else that has been in the works recently is this thing called, let me bring it up here on my piece of paper, the Event Horizon Telescope. Now, it's interesting. One of the things that's true about black holes, of course, is they're very difficult to see by definition. The gravity around a black hole's singularity is so strong, not even light can escape, so there's kind of nothing to look at. But apparently, astronomers this spring are creating a way they hope will perhaps at least better show the outlines of a black hole. Bernie, what's going
yes,
on?
Yes, well, they hope to actually see the silhouette of a black hole, which is pretty dramatic. And as you heard, by next month, they could have some of this data. This is taken with a method called interferometer. So we have about 100 different radio telescopes around the Earth so they can get a wider sphere of the sky that they can study. So they can get a much better image of it, and of course you could never see that optically. So getting some idea of the actual event horizon of the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is 4 million solar masses, and they're also studying the one in a galaxy called M87, which is an elliptical galaxy in a Virgo cluster, and that has a black hole at 7 billion solar masses. So they're really going to learn a lot more things, maybe even about the nature of gravity itself, by seeing this silhouette of this actual black hole and its size.
Mm. And perhaps as well, I mean, the other thing about black holes that's really odd, we assume that black holes, of course, are these objects with a super strong gravity that sucks everything in, but apparently they are also emitters. And that's the other thing that we don't completely understand, correct?
Well, I know that they emit Hawking radiation, which are virtual particles. And around it, of course, if you have an accretion disk, they'll also have jets because you can't put all that material in at once. Some of it will be ejected in that way. So there are different types of emissions. Again, Hawking radiation, Stephen Hawking will probably be best known for predicting this radiation. It's essentially virtual particles. It's like the uncertainty principle. You can't know exactly where you are and know exactly your momentum. And in so doing, by precisely knowing your position, this is, I'm doing a very back-of-the-envelope explanation, the momentum can be such that it will allow it to escape the black hole radiation because it's been known that black holes are so powerful that nothing can escape from them, not even light. But Hawking radiation, because it's a quantum effect, allows it to emit. And through that process of the emission of Hawking radiation, black holes can actually evaporate over long, long periods of time. I mean, the supermassive black hole in our center of the galaxy, the evaporation time is 10 to the power of 66, far, far, far beyond any amount of time we've ever experienced, which is essentially meaningless. And that's another thing as well. And hopefully the information that they glean from this black hole image will help them perhaps start to understand some more of the mechanisms by which it emits some of the material and some of the energy.
Hmm. All right.
Yeah, I think it'll be good, especially if they can, you know, start to look at, you know, more solar mass black holes or in terms of or larger, you know, smaller mass black holes. We tend to look at black holes in the center of supermassive galaxies, which are millions of solar masses. And, you know, that's great. But I think being able to understand smaller ones is a really key thing because our observations of those tend to be more limited. So this has definite potential for that as well.
All right. Again, our phone number here, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Bill, who's in New Hampton, New Hampshire. Bill, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon. Great show.
Thank you.
Does our sun travel in an orbit of its own, taking our solar system with it? If so, how many years is it? And if not, what is it doing with regard to the Milky Way galaxy?
That's a great question. And Bill, do you happen to be standing still where you are right now?
Well, when I'm thinking about what you people think about the meaning of standing still, I probably am not.
I think you're right. We're going to find out just how much. Ed, go ahead.
We're moving at about 143 miles per second around the galaxy, relative to what they call the local standard of rest. It takes us about 225 million years to complete one circuit around the galaxy called a cosmic year. So, yes, the sun and the solar system right now sitting here, standing there, wherever you are, you're moving very, very quickly, not only around the sun, but the sun is taking us through the galaxy as well.
Mm. And then in addition to that, our galaxy is in motion as well.
Right, towards the Andromeda Galaxy, which we will collide with in about 5 billion years.
Wow, amazing. All right.
And you thought you were sitting still, Erwin.
No.
It looked that way, but, you know, looks can be deceiving. Bill, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And if I might, what is the Mayans had three calendars, the lunar, the solar, Earth, and then a third one that I think 56,000 years or something. What was that based on?
All right. I'm not sure. Sean, any idea? Thank you.
Well, I know the Mayans, they had a solar calendar and a lunar one, and then they had one that was sort of, they had these interlocking wheels, if you will, that look at how their calendars lined up. And they had one that was ceremonial, and I think that 6,000 one was more of a ceremonial calendar. But one of the things, their measurements of the sky allowed them to build a calendar that was actually much more accurate than a lot of the calendars that we think of. So it predicted leap years, and it even went beyond leap years to look at, you know, of course, the very precise measurements of our position in time.
All right. Bill, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. Have a nice afternoon. All right. You're listening to Maine Calling right here on Maine Public Radio. Good afternoon to you. Let's go ahead and take another phone call. This is Margaret in Orland. Margaret, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. Thank you for this program. I'm really interested because I just finished reading a book titled Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. And this is written by James Hansen, a well-known, internationally known climatologist and director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
Right.
And he's been, and this book was published in 2009, so it's the alarming call to action back then doesn't seem to have been heeded, and it's obviously getting more alarming. But anyway, he is saying that we are just about to the tipping point now, and that was, what, 6-8 years ago or something? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know whether, and also Stephen Hawking, well-known physicist, laureate, Nobel laureate, has been saying it's time for us to find another planet. I mean, these are very alarming things. And I'd like to know how these astronomers view this and whether they have a suggestion of another planet that we might, maybe we should be going to.
Okay. There's an excellent question. Edward, you want to start us off?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I think climate change is constant. I don't think it's quite as dire. It's unnerving for me to try to contradict Stephen Hawking. I don't think we're going to turn into the planet Venus anytime soon. I think it's much more sensible for us to try to make things as pleasant and congenial and hospitable here. Trying to find another planet. Venus is a blast furnace. Mars is inhospitable. Not only would we have to go to another planet, we'd have to make it suitable for us. And right now, there's no place nearly as hospitable as Earth.
All right, at least in this solar system.
Yes.
Now let's hold that thought, because we need to take another break. When we come back, though, let's talk some more about planets outside the solar system. So we'll take a break. It's a short one. When we return, we'll have more of your comments and questions, so please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Husson University's MBA program in hospitality and tourism management, now offered every 7 weeks starting this fall. Husson.edu.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Just why do teens take so many risks? Are they rebellious, crazy, or is there a neurological explanation? Dr. Francis Jensen will talk about the neuroscience behind the teenage brain with host Adam Savage. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
And that's coming up in just a few minutes at the top of the hour, 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
This week from Symphony Hall, legendary pianist Menachem Pressler is the soloist in Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 27. And Moritz Ganon leads the BSO in Dvorak's New World Symphony. I'm Ron Della Chiesa, inviting you to join us for the Boston Symphony Orchestra in concert.
And that's coming up tonight at 8 o'clock on the stations of Maine Public Classical.
Now, I'd like to say we planned it that way, but we didn't. But welcome back. I'm Erwin Gratz. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest news from NASA and beyond. With me in the studio, Bernie Rehm, author of the monthly astronomy column in the Portland Press Herald and an astronomy lab instructor at the University of Southern Maine. Edward Gleason is with me here, too. He's with the University of Southern Maine's Southworth Planetarium. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Sean Latch, director of the Amera Astronomy Center and Jordan Planetarium at the University of Maine. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-399-3566. That is 1-800-399-3566. All right, so just a moment ago, we were talking about how there really are no hospitable planets in this solar system. What have we learned about the quality of planets outside of this solar system? Bernie.
Yes, well, the quality, well, there's a lot more we need to learn about them, but we did find one possible Earth-like planet around a star just about 4.2 light years away. Then we found several Earth-like planets around a star called TRAPPIST, which is about 40 light years away. So the chances are there, but I still wouldn't stake that much on that. We don't know enough about their atmospheres or if they have them or all those type of things. We would do a lot more research on them.
Well, we are starting to, are we not? We're also continuing to really begin to actively explore planets around other stars. We're putting up more satellites to take a look at stuff like this.
And what's happening?
Yeah,
go ahead, Sean.
Go ahead. I was going to say the Kepler spacecraft, of course, is probably the best known of this, and it did a massive data release recently for the main Kepler mission. It's now on K2 or starting K2, but, 4,034 candidates, around 2,300 confirmed, and there's been 30 of which, are Earth-sized, which have been confirmed out of a little over 100 or so, less than 100 candidates of Earth-sized planets. But one of the interesting things is some of the technology on telescopes is now getting to a point where in the near future we'll be able to look at these planets' atmospheres and really get an idea of what's going on. Is there methane there? Is there, water vapor? Are there, and some of those might give us a better idea of the possibility that these planets are habitable. Again, given the total number of planets that have been discovered, the amounts that are Earth-size and close, the right distance from their star to be in a Goldilocks zone like Earth is very small, but it is getting encouraging. Now, the problem is, of course, wanting to travel to those. Even going to Mars, you're looking at 9 months one way, a year and a half or so on the surface till Earth and Mars line up, and 9 months back, so 3 years round trip. And if you look at even going out to Pluto, it took us 9 years to get out to Pluto. And when you start to talk about light years, you're talking about tens of thousands of years to get to that distance based on the technology we have. And so that's a really serious issue. So, yeah, we do need to kind of think of our own planet as being the place, as Carl Sagan used to say, where we're going to make our stand. Help isn't going to come from elsewhere, and we can't necessarily just get to another planet quite easily. It would be great if we could, but that still is, and for the foreseeable future, really are the things of science fiction.
All right. We've got an email here from Cindy who mentions that at a recent meeting of the Amateur Astronomers Association of Northern New England, there was a presentation about the Mars rovers, Spirit, Opportunity, and now Curiosity. And her question is, did we sterilize those before we sent them up so that we didn't introduce any microbes from Earth? Who knows?
I would assume we would have. I guess.
Yeah. Okay, Sean.
Yeah. They typically do. It's something they're very careful about because they don't want to introduce. One of the things that Spirit and Opportunity they were looking for signs of possible life. So they're not going to they're going to sterilize anything before we send it into space, and all of the landing missions in particular, they spend a lot of time doing that.
All right. All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got some interesting questions here. We're going to start out with Jaco from Abbott. Jaco, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, this is Jaco.
Jaco, all right. Well, welcome to Maine Calling, and what's your question?
Well, speaking of contaminating the planet, when the Cassini rocket was put into space, I believe there was a large amount of plutonium that was on that, and if by some error had blown up in our atmosphere, it would have dispersed particulates of plutonium all around, which could have potentially caused a devastating amount of death on the planet. And I was wondering if they still continue to use plutonium to power the space-faring vehicles and things like that, and what about when if it hits a planet, and what happens to all that plutonium that's on board that craft?
Fair question.
Well, see, the advantage of using something like plutonium is it powers what they call a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and it gives a nice power source, not very heavy. And yes, there is always the potential of having a catastrophe and having it disperse to the atmosphere. Other planets, again, it wouldn't affect us if when they're around other planets. They don't know what contingencies they would have available to them if there were some sort of mishap on another planet. Again, and if it were, let's just say that a probe crashed, it'd be very localized. And if any people at some point were to go close to it, they'd be able to shield it. But again, it's very effective fuel. Because of the way it powers the crafts.
And I don't think they actually use very much of it for the electricity
really.
That's generated. It is interesting to note, of course, Cassini, which is carrying one of those radioisotope generators, is going to be deliberately crashed into Saturn, where it's going to vaporize along with its plutonium fuel.
No one's ever going to actually be on the surface of Saturn because it doesn't have one, and so it won't really pose a danger. Although they do take that into account because you don't want to have anything like that dispersed over a populated area.
Well, and in fact, one of the reasons that Cassini is being sent into the atmosphere of Saturn, is it not, is to make sure that it doesn't crash into any of the moons of Saturn, which are the places that, if there were any existent life, they would be more likely to be found.
Yeah, like Enceladus, for instance.
Yeah, and by
deorbiting
it, I mean, it will burn up, and that's the whole, it will completely burn up. And if you, think going back to the whole idea of these spacecraft, and the amount that's used, typically MAVE, our robotic spacecraft, they use about as much energy on the top end as a hairdryer here on Earth. So there's an awful lot, so it's a very tiny amount, as mentioned. So even if it did blow up on the launch pad here on Earth, it's going to have a very localized effect. It's not going to spread it all over the planet or anything like that, because it's a really, really minuscule amount of this stuff.
Okay. Jocko, thank you for your call. Let's go to Jane next in Brewer. Jane, good afternoon. You're on Main Call.
Hi. I had a question. It's my understanding that climate change, which is causing the melting of the oceans at the poles, it's changing the ocean basins and is ultimately leading to like a shift in the Earth. And I was wondering if there is much knowledge about the implications of this shift.
Sean?
To my knowledge, I mean, we're not having really any tilt changes from this. From the melting of we are seeing a melting in our polar caps, and that's going to lead to a sea level rise, but it's not going to necessarily change the tilt of our axis. That would take something like a massive impact, of a really large meteorite to do, or something of that nature, or asteroid. So I don't think that you have to really worry about that. But the global warming in terms of the melting is it's changing sea level, and it's also creating issues with a variety of different types of sea life as well, because it's changing the acidic levels of the ocean. And there's some thoughts that could be doing damage to the Great Barrier Reef and a variety of other places.
Yeah, because it's primarily the forces of gravity that would determine our tilt. The sun, the moon, the other planets are the things that would affect how Earth is oriented, or as you mentioned, if it were disturbed by an impact of some kind. Yeah,
you'd need something major to shift the tilt of the Earth, and then we'd have some other really serious issues if that happened.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Constantino in Westbrook. Good afternoon. You're on Main Calling.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd like to ask the esteemed members of your panel, of which, something that will cause a extreme tilt in the Earth. A few years back, wasn't there a space object, I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, a Pophros or something like that, that passed very close to the Earth, and they said it's coming back in a few years, and it may pass by closer. Any commentary on that?
Edward.
If it doesn't hit us, it won't hurt. I mean, again, that's what I can think of. We have lots of what they call near misses, and it's always possible with the potentially hazardous asteroids, they have an idea of when things might become precariously close. But as far as I know, nothing is scheduled to really make an impact anytime soon.
We had, it just so happens, I think I may know where this call came from. We had I think it was a 10 radio hour talk on recently, just about a week or so ago, that was reprising a program from a few years back. I think the asteroid is actually Apophis, that was going to pass very close to the Earth and possibly because of its close path, be placed on a path to intersect the Earth in like 2036 or something like that. Anyway, after that program aired, the orbit was refined. At this point, it is not planned to hit us at all on either of its next two passes. So that's where we stand with that. Once again, 1-800-399-3566. If you've got a question for our panel, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Larry in East Booth Bay. Larry, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call,
sure.
And thank you for the mind-expanding program. Wonderful. I'd like to offer a couple of comments in follow to Bill and to the question about the Earth's tilt. The last time I calculated my velocity as I ride on this amazing spaceship called Earth, it's in excess of 60,000 miles per hour. That's largely due to the motion of the sun as it heads toward the bright star Vega inside of our galactic collection. Regarding the tilt, my understanding is that in a period of about 65,000 years, the North Pole shifts in a circular pattern where it's pointing. So in about 30,000 years, we won't be pointing at the so-called North Star Polaris anymore. So I'd like the panel to comment on these follow-ups to that, and thank
sure.
you so much again.
You're very welcome. That the last one you mentioned is precession.
Precession.
And Edward will now explain it to us.
Precession, it's a sort of wobbling of Earth's orbit over the course of about 26,000 years. The North Celestial Pole will migrate along this circle, and in about 2,000 years from now, the star Eri will be our new North Star. Polaris is our North Star right now. It's not exactly on the North Celestial Pole, and the North Celestial Pole will get closest to it on 2102, and then we'll move away from it. About 13,000 years, the star Vega will be our North Star. That's why you have all the constellations along the zodiac migrating as well, because of all this changing orientation. It's all based upon precession. Largely, there are interactions with the sun and moon and, to a lesser extent, the planets.
All right. Let's take one more quick call. Let's go to David in Yarmouth. David, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. My name is David Sonopath. I'm a scientist for the STS, the Star Teaching Society. I work with prophecy and how prophecy fits into everyday life. I wanted to know if you guys had anything about prophecy and what's going on today.
All right. There we go. Anybody want to comment? Yes.
Go ahead, Sean. Go ahead, Bernie.
As a science person, I don't necessarily look at prophecies or things in that in terms of being able to predict science things. I think that's something outside of the realm of things that I would study or explore. So that's all I could really say about that.
All right. We have 1 minute left. As long as we've got a minute left, and we've got two guys here who are running planetariums in the state of Maine. Edward, do you have any new particular programs coming up people might want to check out at USM?
Well, we have new programs once a month, and we will actually be there for the eclipse. It'll be partial, but you'll be able to at least see it with eclipse glasses. We'll have a telescopic image on a billboard.
Okay. Sean, what's going on up
there? Yeah, we have a variety of public programs. Each month we change topics. This month we have Dawn of the Space Age, which looks at, of course, the history of spaceflight, in particular spending some time with the moon landing. And we have a program, Totality, for the eclipse coming up. And we will be doing viewing. We'll have some grad students available, like I said, because I'll be away for the eclipse. But there will be viewing up there, and the public library is going to be providing glasses for that event.
Sean, Edward, Bernie, thank you all for joining us. Ed Gleason at the University of Southern Maine Southworth Planetarium, Sean Latch from the Amara Astronomy Center in Jordan Planetarium, and Bernie Rehm, who is the author of the monthly astronomy column at the Portland Press Herald and an astronomy lab instructor at USM. Nikki Shields ran our board. Sam Dearen answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Tomorrow, Jennifer Rooks and our favorite auto experts. I'm Erwin Gratz. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Thanks.